Today on Rocking the Suburbs.
I really love holiday shopping, Jim. Seeing the stores all decorated and all the happy shoppers looking for their gifts.
Well, I'm kind of surprised, Patrick. I don't really see you as the type who goes to the mall.
Oh, no. The mall's the most horrible place on earth. I'm talking about record stores.
Patrick, how much fun is this to do Holiday Song Countdown?
Tremendous fun here with all our friends and Mike Wagner. he just got me
in that one. So I almost lost my headset.
Oh, you can't steal my joke.
But yeah, it's great. It's great. And it was a lot of fun to go through all these votes and ballots. And again, thank everyone who voted. I got to tell you, I found out about a lot of Christmas songs that I did not know about even being out there, which is, you know, something saying that I've always had kind of a fondness for weird Christmas music and Christmas albums and all that. It was a real big thing with my family when I was growing up. I don't know about you, Jim, back in the early days, did your parents play a lot of Christmas music or were there certain albums?
Yes, they did. It was funny. I think probably a lot of people can relate to this. If you had parents like mine who weren't really that much into music, Christmas time was like the one time a year they would bust out the albums, right?
And
put them on on the stereo. We tended to have a lot of maybe like those compilation albums. I had some examples. You can find these when you go crate digging pretty easily, but my wife has a bunch that she got passed down from her parents. You can find these a lot. There were like albums branded by like Firestone and
totally, man.
Like gas stations would give them out. That's what I remember, like in the holiday season, like you'd buy so many fill-ups of gas and then they would give you a record, right?
Yeah.
Like stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I got one here that was put out by Grant's Department Store.
There you go.
I don't even know what that was. We didn't have them around where I grew up, but it's got the Ed Sullivan Orchestra, which probably is fantastic, along with Cary Grant doing a Christmas song alongside people like Johnny Mathis and Mahalia Jackson that might know a thing or two about it. But yeah, totally. That's the kind of stuff that would be played in my home as well.
It was very comforting, right?
Yeah, totally. Totally, yeah. Although, for some reason, the song Silver Bells still makes me feel weird. I don't know why. It's a strange song, but freaked me out when I was a little kid.
The jingling? I don't know. Okay, it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenny.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We are joined here by numerous friends gathered for this holiday season.
Thank you all.
Via Zoom, and we're counting down listener votes for favorite holiday songs. And yesterday, if you didn't hear that, we did numbers 10, 9, and 8. Mm-hmm. We will open today's show, I guess, with number 7, right?
That's a good place to go, yeah.
Oh, this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas.
All right, of course, that is Happy Christmas, parentheses, War is Over, 1971, John Lennon and Yoko Ono with the Harlem Community Choir. And, fun fact here, produced by Phil Spector.
Yes.
I guess it wasn't that fun. Thoughts on this one, Patrick?
Yeah, I like this record a lot. I've always kind of liked it. And I think one of the reasons I like it is not necessarily the melody or the sentiment, which is, you know, it's all fine and all that. But I like the fact that it sounds like a homemade record, yet it's got this really monstrous, you know, volcanic sort of choir on the back end of it. I love records that are like kind of homemade records that sound like they've been worked on a lot. I mean, anybody's ever listened to music I've been involved in creating can probably tell that pretty easily. But I like this because it feels like, you know, maybe John Lennon did it all, you know, on a four track recorder. And obviously that goes back to Phil Spector too, and the way he created records with a limited amount of space, and he would push everything to the max. But this one feels, you know, less like grandiose in Phil Spector, but it still has it retains a charm that doesn't go over the top. And I don't know, I've always kind of liked this record. I will say though that at the risk of setting Nick Scalera off here, someone made a comment, not Nick made a different comment, but somebody again in the first couple votes said Lennon and McCartney were the greatest songwriters of all time and are personally responsible for two of the worst Christmas songs ever. So I'm not sure if the Lennon one is this one that's being referred to, but we can talk to Nick later about what the McCartney one is. You know, it's interesting that the Beatles handled Christmas right in kind of a different way than a lot of people did. There's no like recognized Beatles Christmas songs yet. They used to make these little Christmas fan club 45s, right, that they would send out to their fan club members that are very, very treasured by huge Beatles fans. You know, it was just them like joking around, right? They would just turn the recorder on and cut up and make jokes and wish everyone Merry Christmas and sometimes, you know, do a little music and stuff like that. But I don't know. This song got a ton of votes and obviously made it into the top 10. I think it's a great song. I always like to hear it at Christmas or the holidays.
I think I was always struck by the fact when I was a kid hearing this song on the radio, like, what is the War Is Over part? Like, what is going on there, right? And so it was only, you know, when I got a little older and was like, oh, yeah, of course this was recorded in the Vietnam era. And, you know, when they were doing the bed-ins and all of that kind of stuff, right? So I don't know how much that matters today. I mean, the song does go into War Is Over if you want it, but it leans in hard to the peace on earth sentiment of Christmas, right?
Yep, without a doubt.
Nick Scalera has some thoughts.
Well, you gotta hand it to John for making a massive guilt trip and wrapping it into a song. Essentially, well, that's sort of the way I love the song. I've voted it very highly on my list. It's not the Lennon McCartney song that I dislike, so spoiler alert there. You know, it's to Jim's point, it's hard to sort of divorce this from its context, but I think it still works. Like that whole marketing campaign, that War Is Over, that stark white, black text against the white graphic. And you still see that on billboards today. They put it up in Times Square and other places, you know, and Yoko will tweet it out. And I just think it's, you know, it's still such an effective kind of marketing message. And John and Yoko were kind of masterful with that for a few years, right, with the bed-ins and everything. So, you know, like I said, it is a guilt trip, but it's not bad getting this reminder every year, you know. Though it was sort of, you know, based on, you know, obviously the Vietnam era, it's still applicable. And I think it still holds its resonance and its power today.
Sadly, true. Mike Wagner, by the way, is opening a bottle of wine for everyone. Just wow. You're interested. That's happening right there.
Is that mulled wine?
Any other thoughts on the John Lennon song?
Come on over. We're finishing up with whiskey later tonight.
So. All right.
No, nothing else. Okay. Let's move on. Where were we? What number was that?
That was 7, Jim.
Number 7. Mm-hmm. We move on to number 6.
Let's do it.
They told me, bum-bum-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum. Peace on earth, can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see. Our see the day of glory. May the day of live in peace. So peace on earth. Where we
All right, that is Dear Bingle, Bing Crosby, and David Bowie with Peace on Earth / it says a slash, not parentheses. Peace on Earth / Little Drummer Boy, 1977. And this was actually recorded for a TV special.
Yeah.
In the UK. And
very interesting.
Various reports suggest that either Bowie enjoyed this experience or didn't enjoy this experience. We don't know for sure whether he was naughty or nice, but I think the results are something that people really enjoy. And I will just say personally, this was played to death on early MTV in the United States.
Really was.
And so we really got familiar with it from there. And obviously you can't help but enjoy the pairing, right? So Bing Crosby is synonymous, I think, with Christmas music, as you mentioned even earlier, Patrick. And then to bring in David Bowie, you know, it's an unusual pairing, but obviously it works really well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll say this just by reading a comment. I mentioned before we started the machines recording, tape machines, that Bill Mulligan had a friend who voted in the poll, and he voted for Little Drummer Boy. And instead of putting the artist down, he said, and I'll sanitize this comment for this family podcast, "Don't be jerks and play something by anyone other than Bowie and Crosby. As soon as you saw the title, you knew precisely what I meant." So I think it is, for many of us, that kind of version. And you know, it's a weird record, which is kind of cool. You know, it kind of meanders off, and Bowie's doing something, and Bing's keeping the center down there by going rah-rum-ba-bum-bum, you know, right in the pocket, as he always did. So it's a really a stark record. I mean, I remember the first time I heard it, I remembered it right away. You know, it's like one of those ones that really grabs you the first time you either heard or saw the performance. So well-deserved place on our list. It's definitely, I think, for one generation, a very, very important holiday record.
Agreed. Now, let's go here to Jason Gulp.
Okay.
So I saw it first time, and I think heard it the first time on MTV. And I remember sort of scratching my head, why is David Bowie walking into Bing Crosby's house, like, and them acting like they know each other? But I mean, you listen to this and it's just their voices are amazing. And it's probably a credit to Bowie that he basically, I don't think he carries the song, but he keeps up with Bing Crosby. So that's my 2 cents.
That's great.
Agree.
Stephen Routledge in Scotland.
I think you maybe touched on this when we did the Bowie countdown. And he talked about how he wasn't afraid to sing with anyone. You know, he sang with Freddie Mercury. He sang with Bing Crosby. You know, these like phenomenal singers in obviously very different ways. But also, this was recorded the same time, the same year he recorded Heroes.
Mm.
So at the time, he's like probably the coolest rock star on the planet.
Yeah.
he's still at the cutting edge of the zeitgeist. And yet he's still done this because, you know, he went on to promote Heroes on the TV show. I mean, I think it was recorded 5 years before it was released as a single, possibly, as well.
Mm.
So it's quite a big gap between it being recorded and it becoming a single. But I guess when it was a single, he was kind of into the 80s. Let's Dance was just about to come or whatever, but, you know, different kind of time. But it's just the fact that someone as cool as David Bowie could do this kind of Christmas song with Bing Crosby, who was the epitome of, like, your granddad.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, totally.
But it kind of goes back to that thing about, yeah, Christmas, it's not cool, but it's also about, let's just put everything aside, all the differences aside. You know, you've got this cutting-edge musician and this guy from a previous generation, and it can still create something magical because they're both really talented guys. Put them in a room together, something magic's still going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Well said.
Now, Patrick and Stephen and others, I didn't know this until doing some research for this show, that whole Peace on Earth counter melody stuff was written for this performance.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So basically he was like, I don't really like the song Little Drummer Boy, and I don't want to sing it. And so the musical director for this special or whatever very, very quickly like wrote a part for David Bowie to sing in this song. Oh, isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. I thought maybe it was something Bowie came up with.
Mike Snyder.
I don't want to repeat everything Steven said, but I remember when I saw this a lot on MTV, and it struck me as a point where someone of, I mean, Bowie's older than me, but the generation of musicians I grew up listening to could fit in the pantheon with someone like Bing Crosby, and you could still enjoy it. I mean, yeah. It kind of justified your interest in musicians that you liked. You know, they fit. It just kind of felt like you had that intergenerational connection. And I just loved it. I've always loved this song.
Well said, Mike. I know exactly what you mean. And it wasn't until later when I started reading, there's a wonderful 2-volume biography by a writer, I think his name is Gary Giddens, of Bing Crosby, man. Both volumes are incredible. They're really long, but when you read about him and you understand like how many groundbreaking things he did in his time, it does make that connection much, much more interesting too. And also, you gotta love the spirit of Bowie saying, man, I don't want to sing this, you know, like that's pretty cool too.
Right. And it became something greater because of that. Right.
Exactly. Some of its parts. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. Now, I mentioned earlier, we have a special guest who's about to join, and that special guest is here now. Fantastic. And please welcome Mitchell Kazin. Did I say that correctly, Mitchell?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
All right. Mitchell Kazin.
Join you guys.
So Mitchell, you can see here on the slide that he's a filmmaker, but I put first record collector, because I think that's more important to this.
Great digger, I call myself.
Great digger, of course.
But yes, I'm also a record collector.
So Mitchell, thank you for joining us. Mitchell made this incredible documentary. I've seen it a couple of times. It's called Jingle Bell Rocks. If you all haven't seen it, you really should. It is tailor-made for music nerds like you.
Oh, man.
And I'll just say real quickly, Mitchell, you can build on this if you want, but you can get it on DVD. You can purchase it on DVD.
You can directly from me.
Yep, there you go.
It's much cheaper.
If you have the streaming service Canopy through your library, you can stream it there. And then you can also rent it on streaming platforms. It came out in 2013.
It was released in Canada in 2013, and then we released it in the States in 2014 through Oscilloscope Labs, which is a company founded by the late great Beastie Boy Adam Yoke. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. The film is becoming the Christmas evergreen that I hoped for, and starting to gain some cult classic status. And I'm hoping for some, you know, in 3 more years when we do the 10th anniversary, it'll be a big deal. So, yeah, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Mitchell, thanks for coming on. And I will add to that, Jim, there's a streaming service called Fandor. I don't know if anyone knows about it. It's actually on there as well.
They're wonderful too.
Yeah.
So let me just set this up for people who have not yet seen this documentary, and I'm sure you will after this. What I love about it is Mitchell really focuses on sort of the more unusual, bizarre, strange Christmas songs that are out there. It's not a documentary that just, you know, says like, here's the history of White Christmas and it became a big selling record and all of that. He really goes at the people who are obsessed with Christmas music. And it's really, really fascinating to watch. And I also mentioned that some of the people who he interviewed in this, John Waters is in it. Wayne Coyne from Flaming Lips is in it. Run from Run DMC is in it. It's amazing. And this all started, Mitchell, because you became obsessed with a Nat King Cole song, right?
Yes, from a very young age.
So talk about that a little bit.
Okay, I will. I don't want to give away too much, but well, I've been collecting Christmas music since going on 31 years now. When I was a wee little lad, I'm the oldest of 4 kids. When my sister was just born, I was like 3 or 4 years old when I remember this record came into the house. It's called The Magic of Christmas with Children. It's a wonderful Nat King Cole record. It's got a whole bunch of weird little ditties on it, like I'm the Happiest Christmas Tree and Mrs. Santa Claus. And on the, I'm pretty certain it's the very last song on the B-side, is a song called The Little Boy That Santa Claus Forgot. And it's a really strange, dark, sad song about how a little boy is passed over by Santa because he doesn't have a father and he has to play with his old broken toys. And for reasons that aren't explained in the song, it's not his fault that his father's gone, but Santa punishes him anyway and doesn't visit him. And for a 3 or 4-year-old at the time, listening to this record, which I didn't understand was even a record, it was a terrifying concept. And that song just resonated with me so powerfully because I didn't understand that it was a recording. I heard this man's voice, Nat King Cole, who has these little spoken word stanzas that introduce each song. So I thought he was talking, he had some sort of like Santa Claus almost, an omniscient point of view on my life. And he was talking directly to me about what was going on for me at Christmas time. And this song was about me. Then the movie goes into more about this, of course, and I'm probably giving way too much now, but I would ask my mother to play the song over and over again, hoping that eventually the story would change. And the boy's father would come home, ergo my father, and then Santa would visit. But of course, in the song, that never happened. And so getting older, that song stuck with me through my whole entire childhood until I was in my early teens. And I longed for that connection to a song, a new song. And I would hear all the classic chestnuts. And I would hear what, it, you know, I'm 57 years old. So I grew up in the 70s and early 80s. Those were my formative years for rock and roll music. And I remember the Bowie Bing song so powerfully too. But none of the songs that were coming out spoke to me in that same way. So I became a little disillusioned with Christmas music, not only because I was hearing the same songs over and over again, but because they just, you know, they were lovely. They were nostalgic. They spoke of a time long since past, if it was even ever real, an idealized fantasy of the Christmas sort of season and celebration we're all supposed to strive for or have. And I just was like, man. So this was all going on in my head, and I was digging at a thrift store, and I came across a record called Jingle Bell Jazz. This is also explained in the film. Mm-hmm. One of the central threads of the movie and one of the biggest songs in my life as a Christmas collector. Some of you may know this song, some of you may not. It's called Blue Xmas to Whom It May Concern. It was written by Bob Dureau, who's the creator of Schoolhouse Rock. Bob passed away a couple of years ago, but he was an amazing songwriter. And he wrote this song for Miles Davis. I found it on this record. The record is a compilation of jazz artists from the day. It was released in 1962, this album. So there's a parallel between Little Boy, the song called Forgot, and this new song that I came across that just hit me so deep and so hard. It's a very irreverent, caustic Christmas song that speaks to some truths about the holiday that a lot of people don't want to talk about. But what was so remarkable for me was, like, finally there's a song that I can relate to, connect to, that hits me emotionally. It's also really hip because it was Miles Davis with a killer band. And what was really cool about it was that it was a song that Bob wrote that was critical of the holiday within the context of a holiday song. And that was something I'd never thought of before, or heard before. And it just blew my mind. And so when I found that record, I thought, man, there's got to be more of these somewhere in the world. So that's when I started digging. And that was back in 1989.
That's amazing. One quick follow-up question to this is, what do you think it is about Christmas music that lends itself to bizarre, unusual recordings?
I've never actually been asked that question. I guess because in one sense, Christmas, for North Americans at least, is a pretty universal experience. There are songs attached to all the traditions that we experience every single year or through our whole lives. I found when I was making the movie that almost every person without fail had that one song that was special to them, like when they heard it at the start of the season that announced Christmas for them or the holiday started. So it's universal, but then it's also deeply personal. I collect a lot of stuff or try to find records by artists who are completely unknown from like the 50s and 60s primarily. Those seems to be the ones that are most interesting musically. I suppose it's people just trying to put their own spin and trying to find something unique to say that hasn't already been said, that isn't about the nostalgia for that idealized holiday. So they're also wanting to create a memorable hit.
Well, one thing that struck me in the movie was you or someone else in the film mentioned that the best crate digging for Christmas and holiday songs is in the 45s because there were so many artists who, like, that was the only shot they got to record a song.
Yeah, absolutely. They could afford to record one song. If you think back to that time, even visiting my grandparents in the early 70s, I can remember you wouldn't hear Christmas music until 2 weeks before Christmas Day.
Right.
So the window for a Christmas song to land, to hit, to make any kind of impact back then for a brand new songwriter, brand new artist, or an aspiring artist was, first of all, the barrier to entry was massive because it was such a tiny little world of Christmas songs then. It's expanded since, but so you had to make a really strong impression right off the top. You had a week where a song could get played, and then that's it. There's no place for it through the rest of the year. So it was a huge gamble and a huge amount of effort and expense and time and hope and dreams. You know, sometimes finding these is just it's just so much fun when you come across one. I'm fortunate to have some record shops that I visited on the journey making this movie, and I kept in touch with them, and now they sort of pull the coolest, interesting records for me. And I got an amazing single from a friend who has a record shop in Oklahoma. The song is something along the lines of, "Will Santa Claus come to rural Route 4 this year?" And I'm like, oh man, just the
title
alone.
That's pretty specific, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, and I said, where is it recorded? And it's like some little town in Arkansas. It's like, oh man, I can't wait to hear this.
You know? That sounds fantastic.
And now it's kind of come back to a singles market with Bandcamp and digital releasing. And yeah, an artist, I mean, there's one really amazing song that happened to catch my ear this year that's going to go on my Merry Mix called My Ugly Sweater. It's by a group, a woman I never heard of. Her name is Jade Ten, and she has this backing group called the Sisters Noel. I think they just made themselves up like this year when they released this song. But right, the songwriter, this is his fifth try at writing a Christmas song.
Mm.
And this one is so much fun. And it's really irreverent and really charming. And it's musically really cool. And there's a great YouTube video for it. It's animated. And that one, it's just an example of just a single that he put out on Twitter. And there's a whole cabal of us that look out for these things, and it got shared, and now everyone's talking about it.
Wow, that sounds cool. And
yeah,
Mitchell, I'll say, man, I love the movie. I just finished it a little while ago before
Thank
we recorded
so
it. It's so fantastic. And I'll tell you, there's two things, and I won't give anything away, folks, but you got to watch this movie. Two things I want to say about it. One, well, make it three things. One, early in the movie, a guy holds up a record that's like this record. And it's, I was like, wait a minute, I have that album. So it was so cool to see
it. So what is that you're holding up, Patrick?
Oh, this is, that's right, I forgot it was audio. This is Merry Christmas from Florence Welk on Coral Records. And that's held up early in the movie, which is great. There's also a part in the movie where, I forget exactly who, but there's a guy in the record store, and he sort of turns to your camera. I'm not sure if it's you or someone else that says, there's got to be some stuff here they're not showing me. that's like, was that you?
That was me in the opening scene of the film where I'm at Amoeba Records.
Yes.
Frantically digging through the stacks of Christmas stuff. There was just a massive, Amoeba is one of the biggest retailers in the United States. And this
I've
been there too.
This is the Hollywood store. And
Okay.
How they were really there? Great to let us film, but we just walked in and asked, you know, on a lark, because I always wanted to film there. And they were really nice. They said, sure. I said, oh, we'll just be like half an hour. We were in there for 3.5 hours. And I knew.
That's the feeling I've had when I walked into every record store in my life, though. There's something they're not showing me here.
And I knew, I could tell just from looking in the stacks that there was other. I'm like, this is Amoeba Records. Come on. There's stuff in the back room that they're not letting me have access to.
Right. There's got to be other stuff.
But I think this is particularly true with Christmas music, right? There's somebody even in the movie who says, like, a lot of times you have to go look in the children's section to find the Christmas music.
Yeah, very interesting. Yep.
That was Andy. So just for everyone else who hasn't seen the film yet, there's a couple of, I call them legendary collectors because they are, and they're well known in the music business. Two of them are featured in the film, and they have lots of interesting things to say. And we go record hunting with each of them, and they discover some pretty cool things, which just by sheer luck happened. I mean, it's a documentary. Nothing is staged. People think some of this stuff was staged. I'm like, no, man. We flew to Alabama with a crew and Andy, and we hit four different record shops, and it just happened to be at Charlemagne, which is now sadly closed. Wonderful record store in Birmingham. And he went deep under where all the records are, into the cupboards, because they said, have at it wherever you want to go. And he went deep into the cupboards, pulled out a box.
Amazing.
And sure enough, he found one of the coolest, most soulful instrumental jazz albums. There's two of them were released by Fantasy Records out of Berkeley in the mid-60s. And they're, for anyone who loves Christmas music, and if you love hip, really cool organ or piano trio-based jazz, these two albums are amazing. And I was so grateful that Andy found that one, because then we could feature it in the film, and it was all worthwhile. And it showed the kind of magic that can happen as a record collector, as someone trying to find these gems, that they are out there, you know?
That also reminds me, too, of the other thing I wrote down watching the film. The what you would call B-roll, I guess, or incidental parts of the movie are very important to the film, at least in my opinion, because I love it the way you did that. You know, some of the stuff you filmed, and it's just might be a city Christmas scene, or it might be like a holiday sale, but also you're like, okay, you know, you're in the car driving, someone's filming you, you're like, we're in Baltimore, we're a little bit lost, we're looking for John Waters' house. Like, that is so great, man. You know,
thank you. I appreciate that you noted that.
So cool, man. And I won't give it all away, but folks, I will say this. This is another reason to watch it if I haven't already made my intentions clear. John Waters, in his house, decorates an electric chair for Christmas. You have to see that.
That's right. I'd forgotten
That's
about
so
that.
So great. Yeah.
I'd forgotten
so
about
great.
That.
And speaking of Christmas decorations, I shared this with some other people too. There's a really nice part from Wayne Coyne from The Flaming Lips.
Oh, yeah.
Not about music at all, but he just is sort of talking about his childhood and about his mother and how she would sort of get depressed in the winter because it would get, you know, darker earlier. But then the fact that that people would put Christmas lights up and holiday decorations on their homes would sort of brighten her mood a little bit. And then he had some great statement. I thought it was just perfect. He said something like, if holiday decorations, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but that if holiday decorations are throwing your money away, then we should all throw our money away.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a wonderful sentence.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Wayne was, he's an interesting cat. I pursued him for almost 4 years.
Wow.
Because he's an amazing artist, but he's everywhere. He's got a zillion projects on the go and he's hard to pin down. I finally paid a fortune to fly and buy a pass to South by Southwest Film Festival where he was screening a movie he'd shot on his iPhone. And I knew there would be a short Q&A afterwards and he would be there and that I could corner him and say, look, you're not leaving this room until you tell me yes to be in my movie. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
It was pretty funny. But then he just surprised the heck out of me. I knew he'd be good, and I knew he'd have lots to say about his original Christmas song that he wrote with the Flaming Lips. But he talks so fast, and his mind is racing, and he's just covering so much ground. I remember at the time when I was interviewing him, I was just holding on for dear life. And I left there thinking, I don't know if I got everything we needed. And we looked back at the footage. It was about a two-hour-long interview in total. He hit so many wonderful points about, like you say, not just Christmas music, but the emotions. Like, he was really into it. And we used him far more than we ever initially intended. He was just so good. So I'm super grateful to him. Bob Dureau's song with Miles Davis was key to the movie. I wouldn't have made the film without that song. And I waited 2 extra years to get Wayne in the movie because it was so, that song and his perspective was so important to me.
That's wonderful.
He's an amazing man. He really is. And that's one of the best parts. And your interview with Bob Dureau is incredible, too.
Yes.
Moving. And I love that part when you give him a hug.
Yeah.
So watch that, folks. And one thing I'll say, Mitchell, I think since you've come on our podcast and we love the movie so much, you should definitely be able to get us on, like, your Christmas mix distribution list.
The Merry Mix, I think, know, right?
The Merry Mix, right? We should get a copy of that, don't you think, for Rocking the Suburbs purposes?
That would be just fine, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Talking.
This year is still almost finished.
What I thought was so cool in the movie, too, is that everybody who's a collector of Christmas music does these mixes every year, right?
That's
and they
so
give them out
amazing.
To their friends. And it was all like,
so amazing.
It was like, you do that too? Yeah, I do that. Yeah, it's like, of course.
So incredible. And the one guy's like, I start usually in January and by Thanksgiving, I have it worked out. Then they tear it up and start over again.
Of course, many more have come out of the woodwork since I made the film and written me really lovely emails and letters. And the one thing that I'm kind of sad about, though, is I couldn't find any females. There was one woman back then. I've since met several, and they're on my list. But back then, there was just one woman I finally located in Sweden. And there's a section in the film where 6 of the collectors contribute their own personal sort of point of view on why they collect. And there's a segment where they film themselves in their homes answering a series of questions I'd sent each of them. But she couldn't get it together. And so, unfortunately, they're all men. And I get a lot of criticism about that. I want people to know, especially the women who are joining us today, that I really tried.
For sure.
I don't know why. I think it's such a male thing, but it's I'd say 80% male, 20% female.
I think it's because women lead more sane lives, maybe.
Yeah, well, my wife would probably agree with that, I'm sure.
More, you know.
Mine as well. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. Thank you very much, Mitchell. The movie is Jingle Bell Rocks.
You guys
highly recommend the documentary. It's the most It's so delightful.
Well, I can offer folks the stream for very little money if they want to contact me through. How can they reach me through you guys?
We can include it in our newsletter, which will be going out
tomorrow. I'll tell you what. Yeah. And if anybody, you know, just reach out to us through the various means. You can hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at suburbspod, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com. So just do that.
And how do people find you, Mitchell, or find information about the movie? Do you have a website set up or a Facebook page?
I have a website. It's mitchellsmerrymix.com.
Okay.
And I can be found more easily if you just Google my company name, which is Mabushi, M-A-B-O-O-S-H-I. That's also my Twitter handle.
Okay.
You can also find me on Twitter at Jingle Bell Rock. So if they just punch in my name, they'll find me.
Cool. All right. Mitchell Kesson, thank you very much.
Really fun.
Wow. Thank you very much.
All right. So thank you, Mitchell. Tomorrow we will have the top five. We're getting into the top five of our countdown. All right. So with that, it's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you all tomorrow. In the street, he envies all those lucky boys. Then wanders home to last year's broken toys. I'm so sorry for that laddie. He hasn't got a daddy. The little boy that Santa Claus forgot.
Oh, you can't steal my joke.